So, these so-called performance cars, do they have a tube that connects their exhaust system to the driver's anus? Because, I find myself increasingly suspecting that the so-called throaty exhaust sound they make is actually the amplified farting of their drivers. Just the other day, I was watching some idiot parking his Mercedes sports car in the car park at my local Aldi. I mean, come on. You want us to believe that you're cool enough to drive a performance car, yet shop at a budget supermarket? I mean, not that there's anything wrong with Aldi, obviously. I shop there myself, but come on! Anyway, the guy was doing everything to make sure that everybody could hear that exhaust. Either that, or, I mused to myself, he has terrible flatulence, and it's all coming out of the tailpipe. Maybe that's why it cut off so abruptly. He suddenly followed through and clogged up the pipe. The fact is that the more I hear those loud exhausts, both on cars and motorcycles, the more like farting that it sounds, leading me to conclude that the only explanation can be that it is the driver or rider who is producing it. This would, of course, explain a lot of things, not least as to why the Batmobile has blue flames shooting out of his exhaust. To the Batmobile, Robin, I've got a violent fart brewing. Moreover, these sorts of cars and bikes represent the ultimate expression of usually male machismo. So it was only fitting they're fueled on farts, as for certain types of man, farting is itself seen as a form of machismo. You know the sorts. They usually play rugby and can be found in groups at pubs where they talk loudly and take pride in the fact they can fart louder and more violently than anyone else, usually raising one leg. To let rip some ear-splitting effusion in the direction of any unfortunate simply trying to enjoy a quiet pint. These are the kind of people who drive these performance cars, usually BMWs, Audis, and Mercs, with equally farty exhaust notes. Now, many years ago, I owned a couple of American muscle cars in succession, and they didn't feel the need to produce farting sounds from exhausts. The American V8 produced its own distinctive rumbling sound, without the need for assistance in the driver's bowels.
Don't say nothing to me! You know them kids was going to shoot me?
Well, listen,
what
I
hell?
Didn't exactly have it
Miss
easy either,
took
you
me
know.
For some big ugly cat with a beard and a mustache.
Well, I can understand
Shut
how they...
Shut up! We're not going to do this stuff no more.
Sidney Poitier and Bill Cosby. A couple of regular guys trying to hit the big time.
What's on that paper?
A letter of introduction.
From who?
I wrote it myself.
Before the big time hits them. Riding with the tide.
All right!
And flowing with the flow.
If you get bored out here and you're looking for some real excitement, there is always the room with the red door in the back.
What's in there?
Happiness.
Sidney Poitier and Bill Cosby easing their way. Uptown Saturday night.
All right, freeze! Everybody slip down in their underwear. You too, lady.
I don't wear underwear.
Can I get an amen? Amen.
You see what I saw?
Yes, I saw what you saw. And don't be worrying about nothing, because if the dude mess with me, I'm going to knock him out.
If you all don't tell me everything I want to know, we're going to beat all the black off both of you.
Just let some cat look funny at me and see if I ain't on this case.
Because my money is in this place. I get mean when you mess with my green.
What you want to know?
Warner Brothers and First Artists present Sidney Poitier, Bill Cosby, Harry Belafonte, Flip Wilson, and Calvin Lockhart in Uptown Saturday Night.
Hey, fool! You can't swim!
I've been back on the blaxploitation of late, catching up with a few more classics of the genre. Now, while most blaxploitation movies are essentially low-budget productions distributed by the likes of AIP, the genre's success at the box office meant that the bigger studios would inevitably want to get in on the act. Likewise, established black stars who would probably not be seen dead in an AIP production also wanted it on the action. Hence we got movies like 1974's Uptown Saturday Night, directed by and starring Sidney Poitier, which came from Warner Brothers. Boasting a bigger budget than any regular blaxploitation movie could muster and featuring just about every mainstream black star of the era, including Bill Cosby, Harry Belafonte, Flip Wilson, Richard Pryor and Roscoe Lee Brown, it pictures itself as a freewheeling comedy. Unfortunately, it never really seems to spark into life. The scenario and situations should be amusing and entertaining, but somehow they just fall short every time, leaving the whole affair feeling anticlimactic. It starts reasonably well, with average working class guys Poitier and Cosby deciding, behind their wives' backs, to visit an exclusive nightclub come casino come brothel one Saturday night. Unfortunately, the night they manage to gain entry under false pretenses, they have a fake letter of introduction claiming they're visiting diamond dealers, is the night that the joint is robbed by an armed gang. As if losing his wallet isn't bad enough, Poitier subsequently realises that a winning lottery ticket was in said wallet. The rest of the film concerns his and Cosby's attempts to recover the wallet while keeping their illicit escapade secret from wives and friends. Unfortunately, after this, the film fails to shift up a gear, with its episodic format preventing any real pace or tension to build up. Of the series of what are, in essence, sketches that follow, only the encounter with Richard Pryor's con man posing as private detective Sharp Eyes Washington manages to muster any real amusement. The other episodes involving variously Roscoe Lee Brown's senator, Harry Belafonte's gangster, Flip Wilson's preacher, are all underwhelming. The climax at a church social outing, where Cosby and Poitier have conned Belafonte and his rival Calvin Lockhart, who carried out the robbery, into exchanging the proceeds of the heist, falls horribly flat, with not even a final car chase managing to generate much excitement. Ultimately, Uptown Saturday Night's problem is that it tries to play it too safe. While it clearly wants to cash in on the blaxploitation bandwagon, it also wants to be seen as more upmarket and sophisticated. So rather than follow any established blaxploitation formula, whether that be black crime movies, horror movies or action films, it seems to want to model itself on mainstream comedy formats like It's a Mad, 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 etc. world. I've probably left a couple of mads out there. Well, it does make reference to the blaxploitation genre in its gangster characters, who are clear caricatures of the same sort of characters portrayed in that genre. Overall, Uptown Saturday Night seems to want to portray black people in a more positive light. The price it pays for this is to sacrifice the social commentary and often ferocious critiques of racism found in the true blaxploitation films, exchanging them for blandness. Nevertheless, Uptown Saturday Night was successful enough to spawn two sort of sequels, also starring Poitier and Cosby in 1976's Let's Do It Again and A Piece of the Action in 1979.
Billy and Clyde, just a couple of ordinary guys doing their part for a good cause.
I'm a milkman.
You're a factory worker. We don't look like nobody who come up with no $20,000.
We're going to look like we got a million. Bungo Slave from New York, huh?
That's right. Biggie Smalls.
You want to see me?
Yeah, I want to see you.
About what?
My name is Bungo Slave. I'm from out of New York City. Me and my boys want to make a bet with you.
$10,000.
Count it.
No need. But it ain't what they do. It's how they're doing it. Warner Brothers and First Artist present Sidney Poitier and Bill Cosby in Let's Do It Again.
Let's do it again.
By day, they're two average family men enjoying a well-earned vacation with their wives in New Orleans. But by night, they're dynamite operators. Trying to make an up-class, washed-up fighter named Bootney Farnsworth into a winner. Ah!
chapter. Who am I?
The Sheriff!
Who?
The Sheriff!
One little personal question, Bootney. How's your love life?
How's his love life?
And while they're at it, turn 20,000 into 100 grand.
You lost, Matt. Live with it. Live with it.
Sure hope you boys don't have an accident on the way home with all that money.
There they are!
Sidney Poitier, Bill Cosby, Calvin Lockhart, John Amos, Ossie Davis, and Jimmy Walker. When you got the cash, when you got the faith, when you got the luck, there ain't nothing you can't do. Let's do it again. Now let's do it again. Sidney Poitier, Bill Cosby, let's do it again.
You know, I still can't get out of my head that claim from our former unlamented Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, back in December, that homelessness is a lifestyle choice. I mean, what sort of twisted thought processes might lead to such a conclusion? Does she really think that people wake up one morning and decide they're going to leave their house and go and live on the streets and said, you know, ooh, what a lovely day. I think they're going to leave everything behind and just find a nice cardboard box to live in. Are there really any cases of middle-class businessmen swapping their four-bedroom detached house company car pension scheme wife and two kids for a park bench? Perhaps she thinks that those of no fixed abode are akin to those colourful tramps of yesteryear, although I suspect they mainly existed in books and films rather than real life, who have opted for a life on the road, free from the rigours of everyday life, chopping wood in exchange for a meal, etc. Mind you, I think she'd have a problem with all those cash and hand jobs they did, failing to pay tax on their earnings. After all, tax evasion is only for the filthy rich and multinational corporations, according to current conservative philosophy. Sadly, of course, today's homeless are mainly the victims of mental health issues, domestic abuse, and economic circumstance, or as many like to call it, government policy. It also isn't something that people willingly enter into as the result of a conscious decision. It's more often than not a long, slow descent, starting with unemployment, low wages, or just general poverty, as an individual slides out of permanent housing to temporary accommodation, through the charity of friends and families via sofa surfing to the park bench or shop doorway. There's no easy way back either, as the lack of a permanent address makes it difficult to claim benefits, let alone secure paid employment. But exactly what is there about modern homelessness that Braverman and her like might think would prove attractive to anyone as a lifestyle choice? The fact that if you have no home or job, you don't have to pay taxes, national insurance and the like, yet are still entitled to be treated on the NHS for the hypothermia you're likely to suffer from in the winter, is that what they think? The freedom from work, social and familial ties, perhaps? The lack of responsibility for family or the payment of rent or a mortgage? Maybe, in her mind and those of too many of her Tory colleagues, the involuntary homeless are one in the same is those types who spend their time, say, squatting in disused buildings, usually on the fairly dubious pretext they're only trying to put to use empty spaces in the face of a lack of actual homes. Rather like those lovable vagabonds, the pre-war Knights of the Road, these squatters are predominantly middle class, with parental homes they could go back to, but choose not to. Most of them working or claiming benefits, the squat providing an address, opting instead to move from empty building to empty building, as the owner's a victim. Now, that is something closer to a lifestyle choice, but it certainly isn't the lifestyle of the homeless people whose tent Suella Braverman wanted confiscated and destroyed by the police. But hey, they're making the streets look untidy. which upsets Tory voters, and we can't have that, can we? Despite Braverman's departure from government for the second time, you can be sure that the government's attitude to homelessness won't soften. Why should they care about the homeless? One of the other consequences of not having a home is you don't have a vote either, which means that with an election looming, they've no use whatsoever to the Tories.
A king of crime is born. A mob boss who started in the streets, ready to do anything for a payoff, no matter what it cost. Became an overlord of the underworld with every trick in the book.
You forget, huh? You make fools of your people. You shame them. They kill you.
You do this to me after I gave you your chance.
Who else am I gonna do it to, huh?
Fred Williamson, in the private war of an angry man, whose hate was spelled out in the blood of his enemies, his violence in the curses of his women.
Look at Hobb. You tell me, who's going to control these people?
It's a jungle.
And it takes a jungle bunny to run it.
Black Caesar. Every mob organization in town is out to get it.
Getting back to Blaxploitation, along with the well-budgeted, star-studded, studio-produced Blaxploitation Cash in Uptown Saturday Night, I also caught a couple of real entries in the genre recently. One of the interesting things about Blaxploitation films was that, although aimed at black audiences and featuring black casts, behind the cameras there are often white directors and crews. This was born of necessity, as particularly in the early 70s, there simply weren't that many black directors, cinematographers, etc. working in Hollywood. There weren't even that many black stuntmen. 1971's Shaft, for instance, although actually boasting a black director in Gordon Parks, was forced to use a number of white stuntmen in blackface for a number of action sequences. But are these white-directed blaxploitation films any less black than those with black directors? Could white filmmakers genuinely grasp the whole black experience and translate it onto film? Of course, the reality of most blaxploitation films is, as the genre's name implies, that they are primarily exploitation films, covering genres such as crime, vengeance, private eyes, action, even westerns. The stories they tell tend to be pretty formulaic, given a black spin by their casting and settings. While there is usually some social commentary thrown in, references to racism and race relations and racial politics generally in the US, the primary focus was on exploitation staples like sex and violence. So, not surprisingly, the directors assigned to them were generally genre specialists like Jack Hill, Robert Klaus, or Jack Arnold, all of whom happened to be white. All of which brings us, by a roundabout route, to Black Caesar from 1973 and Hell Up in Harlem, also from 1973, a pair of black gangster films directed by exploitation great Larry Cohen, who, as his name implies, was white. The first is a classic example of how to successfully fuse together a traditional genre format, the rise and fall of a crime lord, with social and racial commentary. Fred Williamson puts in a dominant performance as the titular character, as over a near 20-year period, he rises from being a shoeshine boy running errands for the Italian mob to being the head of a powerful black crime empire, taking on both corrupt city officials and the mafia. In terms of the story itself, there are no real surprises. But the execution is raw and gritty, with sequences shot on the streets of Harlem, lots of brutal violence, and a genuine feeling of anger driven by the main character's sense of injustice and egotism, a mix that inevitably leads to his downfall. There are a number of memorable scenes as Williamson turns the tables on the white officials and gangsters who've put him down for so long, culminating in his blacking up of the face of the bent police chief whose shoes he'd once shined, forcing the cop to shine his boots. Williamson is backed up by good performances from the supporting cast that includes two of the stars of the same year's Bond film Live and Let Die, Gloria Hendry and Julius Harris. The latter in particular is cast against type and gives a memorable performance as Williamson's absentee father, who although initially seeking to reconnect with him, rejects his son's lifestyle in disgust. Now, Black Caesar turned out to be a big hit on its initial release, inevitably resulting in AIP wanting a sequel. The problem was that the film's climax seemed pretty conclusive, with the wounded Williamson retreating back to the rubble of his now demolished old neighbourhood, only to fall prey to the new generation of young black delinquents now hanging out there. Cohen's solution was a variation on the way in which old cinema serials would often resolve an apparently apocalyptic episode ending by replaying the footage at the beginning of the next episode, but revealing that he hadn't seen everything. Revealing new footage or even reframing the existing footage to reveal that our heroes had made their daring escape before the car, plane, boat, house, etc. crashed and or exploded in flames. So the opening of Hell Up in Harlem gives us a condensed version of the climax of Black Caesar, but inserts a scene of Williamson phoning someone before he staggers back to his old neighbourhood. It also omits the attack by the gang of youths. Instead, he is now found by his father, whom he has phoned in the inserted footage, who is able to contact some gang members still loyal to Williamson, who in turn get him to a hospital. After this relatively ingenious opening, which doesn't compromise the previous movie's ending too much, the film settles down to be a pretty conventional tale of Williamson clawing back his empire before falling foul of a subordinate who tries to take over the operation. While there are plenty of action scenes and a lot of it still looks gritty and raw, it feels far more like a regular blaxploitation piece than its predecessor. The sense of anger and drive just aren't there. Moreover, in order for its plot to work, it has to completely change the character of Williamson's father. Whereas in Black Caesar, he had been disowned by his son, who's quite prepared to kill him for his treatment of his mother, and he had in turn rejected Williamson's lifestyle. Now he not only helps his son, but fully embraces the gangster lifestyle, becoming Williamson's right-hand man. Well, this results in Julius Harris playing a more typical character, swanning around in fur coats and flamboyant dress, meeting out violent retribution. It's still very jarring. Equally jarring is the way in which Hell Up in Harlem seems to lose track of its own and its predecessor's timeline. The end of Black Caesar clearly sets the date of Williamson's downfall as being in 1972, yet the second film, despite picking up where it left off, seems to span several years of action. There's even a caption reading 2 years later at one point, meaning that his action must span into at least 1974, the future as far as its release date is concerned. Nevertheless, Hell Up in Harlem remains a highly entertaining film. It just lacks the depth and sheer rawness of its progenitor. It stands as a good example of the law of diminishing returns when it comes to sequels. If the elements that made the first film successful can't be varied enough for it to seem original, yet reassuringly familiar, then its impact will be severely lessened.
The Godfather of Harlem is doing it again. In Black Caesar, he ate up the town. Now, he's hungry for more. More action. More excitement. more everything.
Oh, say, can you see by the northern light?
Isn't it great to be in America?
Fred Williamson is back, and there's gonna be hell up in Harlem.
You should have stayed retired. Instead, you had to come back into the business and bring your whole family with you.
You seem to think that you can handle everyone and everything by a quick smile, fast remark.
Does it bug you that I can pull it off?
I'm gonna put you out of Harlem, you and your old man.
There's gonna be war like you've never seen before.
Seems to me you're trying to set yourself up in your own business, huh? First Helen, then a few of the boys. Next it'll be me, then maybe Tommy, huh?
I already got it. Look around. I own it.
He's doing unto others before they do unto him. From Midtown Manhattan to the mob's private playground in the Caribbean. From Times Square to the Stratosphere, he's making this world a decent place to die. Fred Williamson, he may never get to heaven, but he's raising hell up in Harlem.
Even hell!
So, why did it take the Royal Mail 4 working days to move a small package from Bristol to Swindon? Moreover, why was it sent to Swindon when it was meant to be being delivered to me here in Crapchester? I ordered something from a shop in Cheltenham via eBay the other week. They dispatched it to me via Royal Mail's 48-hour delivery service the day after, with an estimated delivery date of the following Monday. According to the tracking, it arrived at the Bristol Mail Centre on the Saturday, the day after it was posted. Fair enough. And there it stayed until the following Thursday afternoon, when it was sent to Swindon Mail Centre, only an hour or so's drive down the M4 from Bristol. But there was still no sign of it actually being delivered to me. Although miraculously, it did turn up the following day. Clearly, though, Royal Mail's idea of 48 hours differs radically from everyone else's. I mean, I've got another item bought via eBay in transit as well, and that was posted only a couple of days ago, so God knows, well, just before Good Friday, in fact, so God knows where it is now when I receive it. And on top of that, it took them over a week to deliver my new parking permit, which had been posted locally. Only just arrived before the old one expired. But there you go. I mean, I hate to say it, but since they've been privatised, Royal Mail have become an absolute joke. I don't blame the staff. There don't seem to be enough of them anyway, but rather what appears to be poor management. I mean, management doesn't come poorer than taking the better part of a week to move a 48-hour delivery between two depots, neither of which is close to its delivery point. But hey, that was the kind of week I was having. The frustrations of the postal service were just part of the stuff plaguing me that week. I've also had spats with both the pharmacy and my GP practice. The former gave me the wrong prescription, a repeat of the one I picked up nearly 2 weeks earlier, instead of the most recently requested repeat prescription. The root cause of this turned out to be because the latter, the GP's practice, had not approved the repeat prescription, because they decided for the first time in 4 years that they required a blood test before repeating it. Unfortunately, they haven't actually bothered to tell me this. I gleaned this from the receptionist, the only person in a deserted waiting room in what appeared to be a deserted surgery, but I still haven't actually received a formal request for a blood sample from any of the medical staff, so I can't actually be entirely sure that this is what's behind it. I was told to come back the next day and somebody might do something or might not. I tell you something, I haven't been back since. I ran out of the medication in question, one of the two of which I wasn't supposed to skip unless under medical supervision. last weekend. Nobody's been in touch to check if I'm okay. I mean, I actually am okay. My blood pressure seems to be standing steady, despite the lack of these two drugs. I'll go back to the surgery after Easter and see if somebody will explain to me exactly what it is they want. But like the Royal Mail, a service that was, when I first started using it, good, has been rendered utterly inadequate by what amounts to privatisation. Because my surgery merged with two others and was then run by the US healthcare company Operos. Staff levels fell, service levels plummeting at the same time. It's since changed hands, but the poor service levels continue. Their communication skills, in particular, seem to have gone into terminal decline. I mean, clearly they think that I'm psychic now and know that they want me to do something before I get a repeat prescription, but you know. But hey, sadly, this seems to be a fairly average week in the UK these days. A country with a dysfunctional government, rivers full of shit, literally, and a shambolic, underfunded and understaffed public services. And nobody seems to want to do anything about it. But hey, apathy seems to be endemic these days in the UK. Nobody seems to have the energy or will to do anything about anything. I mean, sure, it's probably down, a lot of it is down to the fact we're currently in limbo with a failing government stumbling toward an inevitable general election, its only objective seemingly being to postpone that election for as long as possible in the vain hope that its poll standings will improve. All it can do is react to events in the desperate hope it can capture the public mood and claw back some support. Unfortunately, the only mood ever seems to notice is that of the extreme right. The interesting thing is that while we might feel that we finally hit a nadir of sorts with the state of the country, in truth, things haven't really changed that much in the past decade. I recently finished reading Jonathan Coe's 2014 novel, Number 11, and was struck by how the Britain he portrays seems quite familiar. A cabal of the super-rich control, or rather are, the establishment and run the country entirely for their own benefit, facilitated by the Tory government. Inequality increases daily, public services are deliberately run down, people can't afford to heat their homes, with many reliant on food banks, while the rich get richer, aided by rampant tax avoidance, while anything that can't be assigned a monetary value is discarded, sold off, shut down. We've been putting up with this for at least the last decade. Why? Have things like reality TV, a media obsession with celebrity culture, and social media really diverted people's attention from reality that much and for so long? I really don't know. But there's no doubt that the right's grip on media ownership really hasn't helped. That, and for much of the period, a weak political opposition that regularly played into their hands. I mean, I'm sorry, cult of Corbyn, but you and your man helped facilitate the parade of increasingly venal and inadequate Tory prime ministers we've had to endure by failing to present a credible alternative government for voters. Still, surely it can't last much longer, can it?
Say your prayers.
First, don't wear a hat in church. Second, you don't buy this stuff, and you don't sell it, and you don't use it.
Right.
Keep quiet, you smell like a distillery.
Get up against the wall. Be cool. Or be cool. The priest and the ex-cop are the toughest super team in town. They're tough guys. Isaac Hayes is the ex-cop who's got some heavy scores to settle.
Father? He's all yours.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Lino Ventura is the priest who's an expert at confession.
Who sent you?
Hey, my friend has your question. I said my friend has your question. Now, who sent you?
Mike Petrella.
Go tell him. And if you wanted to frighten us, he succeeded.
Oh, 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 oh!
they prowl down the meanest streets and into every ghetto hellhole. They're heading straight for trouble, and trouble is Brother Snake. Fred Williamson is Brother Snake, and he's killing anything that moves for $1 million in cash.
That kind of money doesn't interest me anymore. The important thing is to wind up this whole affair so the newspapers can go back to this Watergate and leave my business alone.
It's time for the tough guys.
Say, who are you?
I'm the guy who arrives at the right moment.
When the going gets tough, the tough get going. Tough guys. Thank God they're on our side.
I hate violence.
Isaac Hayes hits hard in his first dramatic role as Soul Brother Number One in Three Tough Guys.
Tough Guys from 1974 is another of those films I've watched on a whim, going into it with no knowledge of the movie nor any expectations for it, yet ending up being pleasantly surprised. It turned out to be an Italian-made blaxploitation film, with its exterior shot on location in Chicago and boasting a strong cast. It also has one of those setups that sound like a parody. Two-fisted ex-con priest teams up with disgraced ex-cop to investigate a series of murders apparently connected to a bank robbery. But in the end, it turns out to work surprisingly well. It helps that the two-fisted priest is played by Lino Ventura, an Italian actor who starred in a lot of French films, and Tough Guys was co-financed with French money. While the cop is portrayed by none other than Isaac Hayes, making his acting debut. The main antagonist throughout the film is Joe Snake, played by Fred Williamson, fresh off of the two Black Caesar films. In truth, despite Williamson's top billing, his is actually a supporting role, and he enjoys minimal screen time. The centre of the film is the oddball buddy pairing of Ventura and Hayes, which proves surprisingly effective, with the characterisations going against the usual stereotypes. Here it's the priest who is the hot-headed rule-breaker, quick with his fists, while Hayes' ex-cop is more methodical and thoughtful and restrained in his approach to the case. It helps that both leads have considerable screen presence. Ventura, who is usually cast as a tough cop or a gangster in continental films, cuts an imposing and convincingly physical figure, while Hayes' softly spoken former cop, while no less physically imposing, brings a real charisma to his down-on-his-luck but resourceful character. The role reversal of priest and cop, the former being headstrong and unconventional, toting a Tommy gun at one point, the latter more of a restraining influence, even extends to the priest having a superior continually calling him up on his conduct, but instead of the usual irascible Irish police captain admonishing a maverick cop, we have an Irish bishop regularly reminding the rogue minister of his priestly duties and obligations. As directed by spaghetti western veteran Duccio Tessari, Tough Guys flies by in a flurry of fistfights, gunfights and car chases, played out against a backdrop of run-down neighbourhoods, grimy back alleys and deserted industrial facilities. It's all nicely photographed, has great production values, the action set pieces are well staged, and it moves fast enough to gloss over the various absurdities of the plot and confusing story developments, and ultimately delivers an enjoyable exploitation experience, helped greatly by Hayes' musical score. In addition to the three leads, the film also features a strong supporting cast, including William Berger as a police captain antagonistic to Hayes' character, or Paula Kelly as the girlfriend of Williamson's former second-in-command, who was mixed up in the robbery, and noted Italian comedian Luciano Selce plays the bishop, suitably dubbed with an Irish accent, of course. Well, Tough Guys might superficially be a blaxploitation film. It only plays lip service to that genre's usual conventions. There's none of the social commentary or racial politics that would often underpin or provide a subtext to the US-made blaxploitation, crime and gangster pictures. Which is hardly surprising, because, let's face it, as far as the Italians were concerned, Blaxploitation was simply another popular English language genre they could rip off, like westerns or war films. So Tough Guys is essentially an action-orientated crime movie in which the various of the main cast happen to be black.
Enter Jim, Dragon, Kelly. He clobbers the mob as Black Belt Jones.
I lost three of my best men in there. Now I'm asking you as a favor.
You're asking me to be the fourth. Get a couple of tanks and blast it down.
Forget it, man. I ain't going in there. It's a fortress.
Well, fortress or no, it's top priority.
So am I. It's suicide.
And dust to dust.
Now, who killed my father? Who's Pinky?
What you wanted for a little mama?
I ain't your mama.
She brought P.
What's wrong, man?
Oh, Black Belt, she is good, man. She is bad.
Boy, what are you talking about?
Sydney. She went into the hip pocket.
What?
She's a fighter like us, man. And she is fast. Ooh, she's bad.
Now, what are you doing? No, no, you stay here till I get back. Do those dishes or something.
They're done.
Black Belt Jones leads his private commandos into the nerve center of a gangland stronghold to crack a super crime conspiracy. Enter Jim, Dragon, Kelly.
You don't need these.
What the hell is that? Panties? That son of a bitch threw his panties in my face?
This is the movie that breaks through to a new dimension in film excitement as Kelly takes on the underworld.
So to round off our musings on the subject of blaxploitation movies, here's Black Belt Jones from 1974, part of the blaxploitation kung fu crossover subgenre that became popular in the mid-70s. Now, Black Belt Jones is mainly of interest because it reunites star Jim Kelly with director Robert Klaus, Kelly having had a supporting role in the Klaus-directed Bruce Lee movie Enter the Dragon in 1973. Klaus's films, regardless of budget, often have a rather rough and ready feel about them, lacking a certain slickness. Interestingly, Black Belt Jones actually has a far smoother feel about it than usual, despite a fairly modest budget. Kelly stars as the eponymous kung fu ass kicker for hire, initially called in to protect a local dojo owner against local mafia-backed gangsters trying to repossess his building by force. Well, he's too late to save the dojo owner. He is able to help out his kick-ass daughter, who actually, as it turns out, owns the business. He also works with the cops to bring down the local mafia. Well, it's neither top-notch blaxploitation nor kung fu action movie. Black Belt Jones is still pretty entertaining, with plenty of well-staged action. There's nothing especially original in it, but it runs through the usual cliché smoothly and enjoyably. While Kelly, although looking impressive, isn't the strongest of leading men, he's well supported by a cast that includes Scatman Crothers and Gloria Hendry, who gives a very strong performance as the daughter. He was popular enough to spawn a 1976 sequel, Hot Potato, once again starring Kelly as Black Belt Jones, but with Oscar Williams taking over as director. Both films were distributed by Warner Brothers rather than AIP, the studio usually associated with blaxploitation. Warner having, of course, enjoying some success with the more mainstream blaxploitation movie Uptown Saturday Night in 1974 that starred Sidney Poitier.
Tell your father he must kill his foreign aid bill to Shang Long by Monday, or we will kill you.
Hello, Daddy?
Lesson to you.
I mean, you can't treat women like the guys with breasts. Didn't your mother ever talk to you about a thing like this? Huh?
You know, there are times when the press seem to conspire to convince us that the UK population is made up predominantly of foaming at the mouth right-wing bigots and racists. I mean, just recently, for instance, in the wake of 30p Lee Anderson's inflammatory comments about the Mayor of London being under the influence of Muslim extremists, which of course lost him the Tory whip, we had various vox pop interviews with supposedly average voters in red wall seats telling us how he definitely represented their views. The intent was clear, to make those of us not consumed by blind hate think that we're out of step, that the average ordinary people are obsessed with immigration, foreign extremists plotting to take over the UK, and ridiculous wokery. It all dovetails neatly with the Prime Minister's recent attempts to redefine the term extremist by demonising protesters. While his immediate reference might have been to those currently protesting for peace in Gaza, you know, a strange group to call extremists, people wanting peace, the wider intent was clear: to link the concept of public process with that of extremism. If you go out on the streets and protest, then you must have extreme views on the subject of the protest and therefore be an extremist. Except, of course, if you are foaming at the mouth right-wing loons protesting about lockdown, vaccinations, 15-minute cities, or any other crackpot conspiracies you care to mention, they're not extremists, just concerned citizens. The overall message is clear. If you aren't a reactionary, anti-everything decent lunatic, then tough. You've already lost, so you might as well give up and don't even bother voting. You see, is it any wonder people are getting apathetic, as I was talking about earlier? But if one looks at the reality of the current political and media landscape, then one discerns a somewhat different story. Most obviously, the Tories are, according to the polls, facing a catastrophic slump in support. Indeed, the further right they move and the more they cosy up to the foaming at the mouth right-wing Nutter Brigade, the further their support falls. Then there's the news recently that Talk TV, one of those supposed news channels that pumps out right-wing bile and is seemingly staffed by serving Tory MPs, is in effect closing down as an actual TV station and moving online due to a lack of viewers. While its rival GB News might still be going, it's still running at a huge loss. Like many of these enterprises, it is bankrolled by expat multimillionaires who don't want to live in the UK or pay tax here, but still want to try and influence public opinion and legislation. And it just keeps shedding so-called talent at quite a rate. mainly because they keep coming out with stuff so offensive that even Ofcom can't ignore it. So it would seem that we aren't actually a nation of bigots, and that support for the right-wing loonies is actually pretty low, despite what the largely right-wing controlled media would have us believe. Of course, my views on how this minority of extremist fruitcakes should be dealt with is well known in these parts. Put them up against a wall and shoot them. Believe me, the spectre of summary execution would soon make them think twice about expressing their vile views. It also has the advantage of creating British jobs. Just think of all the bricks needed for those walls, not to mention the bricklayers needed to erect them. And then think of the boost for the arms industry, with all the bullets required, whilst those firing squads will certainly reduce the ranks of the unemployed.